and welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Shake. You guys, it is Friday, TGIF. It has been a long week, so I am very excited for the weekend, although I will be pretty much working throughout the weekend, but it's the weekend. It's the freaking weekend, so I'm very happy to be here. You guys, I have a lovely guest today. I just learned right before we started this live stream that I had confused him for another person, because apparently brown people can also confuse other brown people for some more other brown people. That is apparently a thing that Mona Shake seemed to have specialized in. You guys, you can catch him in They Thems on Outfest. And he told me another credit, and it literally just left my brain because I saw him from the side of my eye cracking up, and now I totally lost the credit. But he's a very talented commercial and TV actor. Here's my very talented friend, Sean Dasani. How are you?
Mona Shake. I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I totally ruined your second credit, didn't I?
Well, the first one too, actually.
Did I?
Well, the show, you were so close, and I was laughing at the story that you were telling folks. So it's These Thems, which is on Outfest.
These Thems. Okay, not They Thems, These Thems.
Okay. It's okay. I can see why the confusion, right? But it's a hilarious digital series on Outfest now, which is a new platform by Outfest, which is one of the longest running LGBTQ film festivals in the world. Launched their digital platform over COVID because what else are you going to do, right?
Right.
So so it's a great platform. So These Thems can be watched there. And then the other show is Razor Tongue, which is an Emmy award-winning show. It's on YouTube right now, 7 episodes. And I am in episode 1. I get to play very different characters in both of these shows. And they're both comedies. They're both great. So
awesome. Awesome,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very. That's lovely. I mean, Let's start with the fact that you are currently not even in Los Angeles. Where are you?
I am in North Carolina. I'm at my parents' house. I drove cross country in September. It's something I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to go across the country. And so I did. I drove across, had little stops along the way. And then I thought that I was just going to be with family for a couple of months. And the plan was to come back to LA in January. But mid-December, everyone was saying LA was like, I mean, everything was just like spiraling in LA.
Right.
And so I just thought there's no point to go back. So I've been here now, September, October, November, December, January. It's been 6 months. This is the longest I've been back. It's the longest I've been back.
How are you holding your sanity together living with your parents currently? How is that working out as an adult?
You know, I feel like I have to remember that all the self-care things that I used to do, it's so easy when you're by yourself. It's like you can do your routine, you can do your morning pages, you can do your thing. But there's this thing, my parents are very different from each other. Like, my dad's a morning person and my mom's a night owl. So she's going to bed sometimes at 3, 3:30, 4 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
Waking up at 4:30 in the morning. And then I feel like this constant like, oh, I should be awake when my dad's awake. I should be there when he's having breakfast. Like, I feel that I should be doing, you know, all these things. But, like, sometimes I don't sleep till late myself. So, I don't know. I have to remember to have my self-care practices.
Yeah.
So, I think I've done my journal, like, 3 times since I've been here. And those 3 times, I'm like, don't forget to do it tomorrow because you need to be doing this stuff. Like, it's tough to be an adult around family after not doing that for a while. But,
yeah.
They're great. I can't complain. At the end of the day, my parents are very, very sweet.
Now, Sean, is your family from India?
Yes. Yes. My dad is from Mumbai.
Okay.
From Pune and Mumbai. He spent time in both places as a child. And my mom is from New Delhi. And they, my mom is Punjabi. My dad is Sindhi.
Wow.
They did not meet until they came to the U.S., so they actually had a love marriage. They met in North Carolina of all places, because I mean, how many South Asians are you going to meet in North Carolina in the 70s?
So one. You're just going to meet one, and you're going to marry that person.
You're going to marry that person and be like, yo. And yeah, so that's what happened.
It's you and me here. Let's just get married at this point.
For sure. Yeah. It's a funny story because my dad is like 8 years older than my mom.
Okay.
And he knew her uncle. And so when she first met him, she was introduced to him. And it wasn't like a arrangement or anything. It was just like a coincidence.
Yeah.
She met him as her uncle's friend. And so when she first met him, she called him uncle when she first met him. And he was like, I don't call me that. Because he, for him, he felt like love at first sight.
Oh.
Our way of, you know.
Uncle, are you interested in marrying me?
Yeah.
No, that is adorable. No,
not at all interested. Because she was so young. You know, she kind of.
Right.
She actually was interested in drama and the arts. Like, she was an actor in India, like in high school. So that's a lot of what she did. And so I think I got that from her. Like, I see a lot of the parallels.
Yeah.
So, like, my family, you know, they've been supportive of my creative career.
Right, because your mom wanted to be an artist. Well, yeah. I mean, what was your mom studying? Your dad was, like, a full-blown professional already in North Carolina? Is that how that kind of connection happened? Because your mom is 8 years younger.
Yeah, well, like the Cindy men at the time, a lot of them went into the same line of work, which was custom tailored suits. So my dad left India. He went to Hong Kong where he had like uncles who taught him how to be a custom suit. Like,
whoa.
Like, how do you measure people? How do you take measurements? So this is crazy because I heard this story not too long ago. It dawned on me like just recently that my dad didn't have the internet when he was running this business. So I asked my dad recently, like, how did you find customers? How did you advertise? How did you do all that stuff? I felt like really silly asking these questions. He was like, look, in the 70s, he went to Hong Kong for like 2 years to train. He came to America and he had a suitcase full of fabrics and then another suitcase with like his stuff, right? So he would go to like different cities like Chicago, LA, New York and all that. And he would go into a hotel and he would set up shop and he would put out these samples of fabric. And like the week before he got there, he would put an ad in the newspaper, you know, such and such fashions coming to the Holiday Inn, you know, custom tailored suits and all that stuff. And he would get all these like doctors and lawyers and like business folks to come and he would measure them. He'd send the measurements back to Hong Kong. They'd make the suits. It would take him 3 weeks. In the meantime, he would go to other cities, come back to that first city 3 weeks later, get the suit, and then deliver it to the client. And he was using the newspaper and the phone book.
Wow.
And his customers. It seems like, of course, that's what you would do. Those were
that's brilliant, though. But that's it's so simple, yeah. But it's so brilliant.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow. And what
I'm used to, like, the technology that we have now, that I was like, how could I not have put together that's what he had done, but I've never had the hustle in that way because I don't like all these tools. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude, that's a brilliant hustle though. Like, right? International, like custom made suits. Like, oh yeah, we're gonna put your order in. 3 weeks later, you're gonna get your new. I mean, that's freaking brilliant. And what about your mom? Like, what did she go to school for?
Yo, my mom.
You said she was a theater major. She was a drama.
She studied, she never like finished college. And actually my dad never went to college. So my mom was doing in high school in India. She was like part of the drama program and she did plays and stuff. So she came to America when she was 17. She was quite young. So she was married by the time she was 18.
Yeah.
She had her firstborn at 19, which is my older sister. She had me at 20. And then a few years later, she had my younger sister. So she never like got a chance to pursue like in the, you know, the career that she wanted to. But she's always been an amazing mom, you know?
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot from her over the year. Yeah. I think like, sometimes I look back, I'm like, man, the level of sacrifice that she made for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you had to love us so much to be making those kinds of sacrifices. And I think that's something that parents understand in ways that, I don't know, maybe I'm like, I wouldn't do it. I'm like, my kid, I would not be making those kinds of sacrifices. I don't have kids. So maybe that's
guess who else doesn't have kids? This chick right here. Like, I honestly, John, for me, it's just like, I think the older I get, the more it becomes about, do I want to pass on my fucked upness to somebody else. And hey, I'm like, I'm not making an eyeball only to fuck it up. Like, I'm not doing that. I'll adopt kids, but yeah. I just feel like the world is so overpopulated. Why can't we take care of the kids that are already here rather than go out and make a new one? Like, why?
You know, I feel the same way. I also think as creative people, like there are other ways of like birthing. There are other ways of like leaving something behind or putting something out there. And not that it's the same thing at all, but it's our way. You know what I mean?
Yes. I 100% agree. I mean, so you're a middle child. You're an older and a younger, right?
I am. I'm just
going to put this out there right now, Sean. This is like a pretty middle child syndrome. I'm sure you've heard of it. Uh-huh. Hanging out with your parents during the pandemic. I'm just saying.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Yeah. I am classic to a T. I am like always there. I'm the only one that's like in a creative field. I'm like very different from my siblings. You know,
what do they do?
My older sister is in the medical industry. She's a physician's assistant.
Okay.
Endocrinology. My younger sister is in real estate. She's a commercial real estate broker and also very savvy investor. Very, very smart. They're both very, very smart.
I love that. Well, you're smart.
Thank you.
You're saving money living with your parents right now. That's brilliant.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Mona. You make me feel good.
Yes, you're saving money. Fuck that. Who wants to listen? If I had family where I could just pick up my shit and just go stay with them and save a bunch of cash, I would. But I don't have access to stuff like that. You know,
You can come over.
You're so sweet. I would love to. Before the live stream started, you said that your mom like treats you like as if you're still a baby or still a child. You said that she doesn't even let you do the dishes.
She doesn't let me do the dishes. I still
That's amazing.
Try and get it in. No, I'll tell you what. My dad would tell me, you know, a couple months ago, he was like, your mom loves you more than she loves me. I was like, what do you mean?
Wow.
So I literally would see moments where, okay, we do this. I got them into the habit of, I'm a health nut. Mm-hmm. I got them into the habit of soaking almonds at night. And then we eat our almonds, like peel the thing and it's all soft and soaked. It's supposed to be like better for you and stuff. And, 30 almonds because we each eat 10. And so for a while we were running low on almonds and my mom would tell my dad at night, like, there's not enough almonds for you. These are all for him. And then I wouldn't know anything about it until the next morning I'd see my dad and he's in a weird mood. I'm like, what's going on? Like, what's up? And then he didn't want to tell me because he felt like he was going to get in trouble. And so I was like, later that afternoon, I'd find out that my mom was really like, no, you can't eat it. Or that's his bread. He eats the gluten-free bread. Don't eat his bread.
Wow.
She's seriously protective in some way.
Dude, mom's looking out big time. Are you kidding me?
For sure.
Your mom is like a giant cheerleader of yours.
And like, she is.
Plus like bodyguard and soldier. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know what I did in the last life to deserve so much protection.
Aw, well, you're a lovely human being. Why wouldn't you deserve it? I wanted to actually ask you, did you, when you, you know, you're born and raised in North Carolina, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you were growing up, did your parents teach you Punjabi or Sindhi, or were they of the mindset like a lot of immigrants were or have been that we want our kid to assimilate in, you know, and I don't want my kid to stand out because we're immigrants and get picked on, so we're not going to teach him the languages, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like it was a little bit of both, because yes, Sindhi was actually my first language. I grew up mostly around my dad's family. He has a big family. My mom's family is a little bit smaller. And I grew up around all my dads. And my mom actually learned Sindhi like super quick. Sindhi was my first language growing up. I really didn't learn English till I started going to school. And then I started learning, like listening to and picking up on the different words and stuff. And then of course, like TV, cartoons, all that stuff. But I feel like there was this sense of, we want our kids to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I feel like we didn't talk a whole lot about my parents' history. And as a kid, I'm like, I don't know why I never asked them. Like, I didn't learn so many things about my parents until like well into adulthood. So I don't know why we didn't talk about, like, where were they during partition? Like, what about, like, what was the 60s and 70s? Like, we didn't talk about a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, I think they didn't want us to be so different. And North Carolina was such a, like, especially Fayetteville, which is the town I grew up in, it was very, like, black and white. There weren't a whole lot of, like, South Asians when I was growing up. And so we just, I think we all knew to kind of keep our head down and blend in. Because mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to explain, like, Mona, it wasn't even just being the brown thing. I was like, you were also vegetarian. And so, like, when I would tell my friends I'm vegetarian and then I would bring these, like, veggie hot dogs, I'm like, I didn't know how to explain to them what are veggie hot dogs when they look like real hot dogs. So I didn't want to have, like, conversations with people to explain things. You know what I mean? So I'm like,
got
I
didn't it.
To, like, not have to explain myself. And then, like, gender identity stuff too. Like, I didn't, there were so many other things to unpack that I didn't get there until later in life, you know?
I mean, you just mentioned about the gender identity part, right? It's funny because, you know, I've looked at your Facebook profile, but I think when I look back at it and I saw some of your old pictures, and you actually, when you had your short hair, I went through a phase when I had super short hair, and we looked related when I saw your pictures, and I was like, oh my God, Sean could, like, easily be my cousin. Like, Sean's pictures are so similar to mine. I mean, when you talk about, like, gender identity, right, Sean? I mean, you're a trans man. How early on was it for you when you were just like, you know, this isn't the right body for me? There's something off.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, like, I just thought I was a boy up until I was, like, I don't know, like, 8, 9. I just thought, like, I knew something was different, but then I just thought, oh, it come together. So, like, at 3 years old is usually the time when most people start forming their gender identity and kind of seeing, like their parents, if it's a two-parent household, you know, they see mom, dad, or they see their mother figure or father figure or whatever, and they start kind of understanding and seeing a difference, like, being more observant of that. So, literally, I remember being 3, 4, 5 thinking, oh, I'm going to shave my face like my dad. I'm going to, you know, wear suits and ties, like, because I would watch him, like, get ready in the morning. And it wasn't until, like I remember at 10 years old, I could see, like, girls were starting to wear bras in school. And something up here was like, uh-oh, I hope you don't ever have to do that. You know? And then, like, puberty was like, oh, man, it was, like, terrible.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought, you know, so I have 2 sisters. I have an older and a younger, but I also grew up around a lot of cousins. And so one of my cousins who was 3 years older, we were like best friends. And he was like my male kind of like who I wanted to be and who I like. He was like my brother. You know, I looked up to him. And then my older sister was a year older. And so I saw her and I could feel like the expectation was to be like her, like with aunties. Like, I could see that people were expecting me to kind of be like her, and but I just want to be like him, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you still kind of consider him a role model for you, or that was just a kind of a childhood phase you were going through?
You know, so he passed away. That's okay. You know, I mean, I still feel his presence. You know? I don't know. I'm sure his soul is where it's at, but I will always remember him.
Yeah.
He passed away when I was just before I turned 20.
So, was he sick?
Yeah, he had kidney disease.
Jeez.
He had kidney disease for a lot of his younger life, but he wasn't diagnosed until he was a teenager. I learned a lot about dialysis. So he was 16. I was 13. And he had it, you know, his body held it for like 6 years before, you know, he was just tired. He was tired of dialysis treatments and kind of the back and forth. And he really didn't actually want to have a kidney transplant. From the research that he had done, he wasn't convinced that it was the way to go. Yeah. So he made a decision not to have a transplant. And so...
Wow.
Yeah, at some point his body just couldn't
give out. Yeah. Yeah, your body just gives up. I have a good friend of mine. She, you know, it's interesting. When I met her in doing Groundlings. She was doing improv. She is actually a big time executive at Netflix now, believe it or not. But when I met her, she was just doing improv, and she was like climbing her way up, you know, to becoming the executive. And I remember meeting her, and she's just a lovely, kind, gracious human being. And, you know, I didn't know, like, you know, she was like, yeah, I'm on a wait list for a kidney. I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, I have this autoimmune thing where my body attacks my kidneys. So both, and it's a hereditary thing. She's like, the same thing happened to her father, and she inherited the same thing. And she was on a waiting list, and finally she did get a kidney, and you know, she lives a very happy, healthy life. But she literally transformed. She went from being, you know, she was a little bit overweight. I think the, you know, whatever the dialysis, they were like messing up her body big time. Yeah. And the moment she got the kidney transplant, boy, she lost all the weight, svelte, like great in shape. But you know, she told me what a nightmare it was to get on a waiting list just to get a kidney transplant.
Man, and you're talking, you know, it sounds like this wasn't that long ago. I mean, this was happening for him in like 1997, 1998, around that time frame. And in North Carolina, you know, in rural North Carolina. So first of all, I do want to say, like, sometimes I think when you're in a smaller city, when there aren't a whole lot of other ways to imagine your life.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know what's out there for you? Because you know, we also are a close family. Like, everyone was right here. It's like nobody had ever, I was the first one to leave. I was the first one to say, hey, I want to go to film school. I want to see something different. Because I couldn't imagine myself dying in North Carolina. I couldn't see a future in North Carolina. And it's everything's changed. You know, a lot of things have changed here. And
well, Sean, you don't have to worry about dying in North Carolina because LA has a giant fucking pandemic. And it's
how's that over there?
It's killing people left and right. So don't worry, LA's got a pandemic. Don't you worry, Sean.
Very comforting, Mona.
Listen, I'm living in the epicenter right now. All good, baby. For sure. All freaking good. Sean, when you wanted to become an artist, I mean, were your parents kind of traditional to be like, we want you to become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, or they were just kind of cool, supportive parents?
I mean, I think like any parent, like they want to see their kids stable. They want to see their kid like able to stand on their own, take care of themselves. So I think they just wanted to know that I'd be safe and stable. But I remember when I was telling them I'm going to go to film school, because that's what I did first. I moved out to the West Coast for film production because at the time I hadn't transitioned. At the time, I didn't know that I could transition or there was a such thing as being able to physically transition. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't about to like begin a career as an actor, even though I knew that that's something that I wanted to do. Like I've known that since I was a kid. I didn't like audition for female characters or roles because that just didn't feel right to me. So I studied behind the camera. I went to Chapman, which is down in Orange County. Yeah. And, you know, I learned everything from producing, directing, cinematography, editing. Like, you learn a little bit of everything out there.
Right.
And when I told my parents that I wanted to go, they were really scared. I think the first thing they thought, and I remember, like, we had some conversations about this. Like, they kind of sat me down. And they talked about, like, what Bollywood is like and, like, how tough it is for women in Bollywood and the types of things, you know, and I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I ain't gonna have to deal with any of that mess. Like, I mean, you know, it's not like stuff doesn't happen in Hollywood. Obviously it does.
Sure.
I couldn't understand their thinking.
Yeah. Have you heard of Harvey Weinstein? Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. We're, you know.
Who doesn't want a overweight, gross looking dude jerking off in a plant in front of you? I mean, come on, people. These are winning combinations, people. Let's go. Let's make that happen. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunate. You know, I think I'm not the biggest person on social media. Like, I like to have time off in nature and not be tied to electronics or computers or social media and stuff. But like, the value in what we have now and being able to communicate in this way and being able to, I mean, Me Too, you know what I mean? Like the Me Too movement and like any social movement, it's like we're able to communicate in such a, in a much more powerful way today. We didn't have these tools before. You know, yeah. And I feel like we're able to have each other's back in a way today where if something happened to somebody back in the day and they're like an actor like coming up on the rise, especially as a female bodied or female presenting person, then I mean, it's like they would be told like your career is over. Like you can't say this because blank. And then like, how would they ever like get the support that they need? You know what I mean? Like I feel that it's very different today.
Yeah.
And the awareness that's being put out there, even for men, to know like what's acceptable socially. Cause if you think about it, like the messaging to guys from a young age is to like hunt or pursue or to be persistent, you know, all of those things can be really like without understanding responsibility, like all those things can steer guys into a really terrible space. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like, look, I think globally, look, we come from a culture that's a highly patriarchal and a very toxic culture when it comes to those kind of things. Like the misogyny is rampant. Not that misogyny isn't rampant in America, in the Western cultures, but not as much, perhaps. You know, I mean, as a woman who grew up in Pakistan, I assure you that, you know, the kind of shit that I witnessed and experienced, I mean, you know, you share that stuff with people and they're like, what the fuck? Like, what kind of fucked up shit have you seen? Like, you know, I mean, for me, I don't know. I mean, did you as a kid go back to Mumbai a lot or to New Delhi? And was that?
We went a few times. We went to India like at least, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. So not like many times, but each time I went, I was like, I could feel the difference. Like I could absolutely feel the difference, especially as someone initially red and presenting maybe female.
Uh-huh.
And somebody who then also presented non-binary where folks couldn't tell my gender. Mm. Like a lot of times because there weren't a whole lot of female-bodied people with short hair, like a lot of times I was just, people just assumed I was male, but then I would get the look, you know, like the unsure look. But yeah, it's dangerous, man. It's dangerous in some parts of this world for women. I mean, it really is.
I mean, I think women have just been eating shit since the beginning of time. And in many, many countries, they continue to, sadly. I mean, this is a statistical fact in America that three women die every single day at the hands of their boyfriends and husbands right here in the United States of America. And you'll never hear their names. They're just a statistic. That's all they are. So this is it's a real issue, right? Like India has what? Like every 3 minutes, a woman gets raped. It's a problem. It's a fucking problem. Like it's an epidemic. Like these are really big issues when it comes to the female gender. But I mean, for you, Sean, I'm really curious to know, like, that process of you going through that. Like, were your parents like sitting you down and trying to talk to you and being like, hey, or your mom saying, hey, why aren't you being more girly? Or, you know, why don't you do that? My mom would try to push that shit on me and it would fucking drive me absolutely nuts because I was a tomboy. I grew up with 4 older brothers. I mean, I don't want to be a girly girl. Why should I? I don't have sisters. I don't have girly girls. I'm a tomboy. I want to dress up like my brothers. My mom always tells me these stories that she would dress me up in like these nice dresses. And whenever the guests would come over, I would take my clothes off and go streaking in front of the guests.
I'm like, How old were you?
5, 6 years.
So I'll answer your question, but I'm curious now that you're bringing it up, like, when did that change for you? When did tomboy feel like a phase for you? Or do you feel like you're still a tomboy?
I think I'm still a tomboy in many ways. I think being a stand-up comic, I think requires this kind of layer of like maybe this thick skin that can come across as tomboyish, right? Okay. But I think for me, the kind of transition about, you know, tomboy being a phase, I think for me, tomboy was also this self-protection thing. It was a protection thing that I put up, you know, on myself because I thought that girls were weak and men were strong because that's what I saw. I saw a lot of domestic violence. I grew up in a very domestic violent home. My dad would beat the living shit out of my mother. My dad would beat the living shit out of me. And I thought that if I was a boy, he would not have as much power over me, right? I'm a boy, so I can, or I can be a tomboy and I can defend myself and I can stand up for myself. I think for me, the biggest thing was that I did not like wearing bangles, the bangles. I always thought in my mind that they were like shackles, like you were putting shackles on my hand. They were like handcuffs. Mm-hmm. Although they weren't, right? But in my mind, and the reason that I translated as such as a kid is because one day we were coming back from my grandmother's house. I remember this, I was like maybe 7 or 8 years old. We're coming back from my grandmother's house and we're at a red light. And there is this, I look over and there's this car next to us and this little girl is crying. And I look close and I'm like, oh my God, why is she crying? And I look in the front and her dad is beating the shit out of her mother and her, she's wearing glass bangles and they're getting smashed against the window that's rolled up. And I see blood dripping down her hands. Yeah. And in my head, in that moment, I was like, as a kid, I was like, woman means weak. Bangle wearing means weak. Do not wear bangles. No bangles. Nothing feminine. Especially too feminine. I'm out. No lips. I mean, I was like, I look at my pictures and I can't even recognize myself because I've just grown so much as a person and just come in, you know, come together as a woman that likes to put on makeup and get her nails done and get her massages and get her fix her hair. But that was a long process for me to be able to find security within myself to be like, I can still be feminine and I can still be strong. And that was a lesson that took me many years to learn, many years, you know? And I guess I'll turn around and ask you the question. I mean, how was that for you? Like, what, you know, what was your kind of process that you were going through?
You know, yeah, it's interesting because I don't know that I didn't have that. I had a very, very, very different experience. So first of all, before I launch into that, like, thank you for sharing that because I realized like how much that is to process also as a young person. You know, I mean, we're a kid.
Right, you don't know. I mean, as a kid, I just didn't know. Sean, yeah,
I feel like the visual is still there. Like it's still internalized in some way. You know what I mean? Like, sure. It was like, something's not right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And that's like a lot for like a little kid to kind of like, it affects us. It clearly affects us, you know?
I mean, look, it shapes how we see the world. It shapes how we see relationships. It shapes how we see ourselves. I mean, it's a massive, massive impact on for the rest of your life. You know, you're basically spending the rest of your life trying to unfuck yourself because your head was fucked with, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And it's important to do that work.
Right.
Like, in whatever way it looks like for every individual, it's like we kind of have to because like everyone comes from their own like damage, so to speak, as kids. Right. Like I think it's part of our job. It's part of our journey as like souls, I think, to kind of like learn what that is and like try to like get through that. Like I'm even thinking that now, like in moments when I'm triggered, like being here with family, it's like when I see myself reacting in certain ways, it's like, dude, listen, that's part of why you're here. Like, if you thought you were patient and you're seeing yourself acting like completely like a fool with your fam sometimes, like understand that that's something that you have to still work through. Those are lessons you haven't learned yet. So like do the work and understand where these things are coming from. You know,
sorry, what did you say? Act like a fool? Is that what you just said?
Like I find myself get like really impatient sometimes. I find myself get really Yeah, I get really bothered sometimes because I do things in my way. Like, and this is true for everybody. It's like I do things my way. It's like my parents are going to do things their way or whatever. And, you know, without going into too much detail, but like, yeah, I see myself like getting like really upset sometimes at the way things are done. And I'm like, yo, okay, just calm down. You just need to calm down.
Well, you're saying you don't know what triggers you. You don't know where that trigger is coming from. Is that what you mean?
Well, like I have to stop. I have to slow down, I think, a little bit when I'm around family in ways that I don't have to when I'm just like out there living my life. Because when it's just you, it's like you don't have – obviously you think everything you're doing is like the right way of doing things. Otherwise you wouldn't be doing it, right? But like when you're around like other people, you're like, hold up. Everything's different. It's like,
that's right.
I'm finding myself having to like slow down just a little bit and like have like more patient conversations through things like health. Like I was saying to you, like health and wellness is a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
So I have not answered, like, I think 10 questions that you asked me.
That's how my episodes go. It's a tangent. It's all over the place, and I love it. It's fine.
But I want to go back to, I know we only have so much time, so I do want to go back to talking about gender for a little bit.
Yes.
Because, please. You know, I didn't necessarily think of girls as weak and boys as strong. I just, there was something just in my brain that aligned with being a boy. Mm-hmm. The brain chemistry is different. Like the male brain and the female brain.
Absolutely.
Are different. You know what I mean? And so like what was jarring to me was my body. What was jarring to me was like, why does my body not fit what's in my head? And then like, why in my mind do I see a version of my body that's not actually there? You know?
It's hard to
describe what that feels like beyond what I've just said, because I don't think I would be able to understand unless I'm living it. And I think that's what, like, I get, it's really tough to have conversations when folks are transphobic or want to say like, no, there's only two genders. That, you know, it's like, how do you know? How do you know that if you haven't experienced it? You know what I mean?
And
I think in these moments, like, I actually hold my allies really close, because I'm like, you haven't lived it, you haven't experienced it, but you can have faith in it.
That's correct.
And you can have empathy for it. And at the core of it all, my parents have been supportive in that
process. I love that.
You know, when I was first understanding that I could identify as male, I told my mom first. Like, I told my siblings, but after that, I told my mom before I told my dad.
How old were you when you came?
Oh, man. Then you would know how old I am now. I mean,
I'm not as good at math as you think I am. Just because I'm a brown person, what? That means I'm good at math now, Sean? What kind of stereotypes are we playing into here? I'm not good at math. I'm a college dropout, for fuck's sake.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Well, then, no. But I mean, I was an adult. I was like a fully grown adult, and I.
Oh, you were. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Because, I did tell her, but I wanted, you know, I kind of like put it out there. Had she heard of anyone transitioning before? And she had heard of Chaz Bono.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think as soon as she understood that that's what I was talking about for myself, she was terrified. You know, what will people think? What will people say? You know, and then as we got closer and closer towards what it meant to physically transition, she was more afraid from a health perspective.
Yeah.
Could it hurt me? Could I, you know, what could happen? What damage could I cause? So she had a lot of fears. And, you know, my dad was a lot more, he didn't vocalize his fears to me. He was just much more, he took it in. And I think on his own, he probably did some research, and he always wanted me to feel that that whatever decisions I was making in life were my decisions. He always wanted me to feel that. And I feel like he has a really lovely way of just asking, do you think, and why do you think you want to? You know, he has a really lovely way of asking to understand without telling his kids what to do. And I really, really appreciate that about him. And I don't know if that's something that happened over time. Maybe that's something that happened over time, because it's something that I've come to appreciate anyway over time. My parents both were, I think, post the physical transition, they saw that I was actually in a much better space with myself. And I think that that was important to them, you know?
I mean, for you, like, as an adult, like, it sounds like your parents are pretty awesome people and should totally adopt me. What about your siblings? I mean, and your friends, people you grew up with. I mean, how was that? I mean, I would think North Carolina is a little bit on the conservative side.
You know, yeah, I think for sure. I mean, it's part of the Bible Belt, you know, and it's interesting because my dad's a business person out here. And he has a lot of business community. I mean, he knows folks, bankers and, you know, lawyers and all. So a big business community. And Fayetteville is pretty tight-knit. Like, it's not that hard to get yourself known, you know, in this town and get to know a lot of people and stuff. And so, you know, it's like when a person does physically transition, their community does too. Like, their siblings do too. Like, my sisters had to now say their brother, Sean, and my parents had to say their son, Sean, and hi, Tim. Are we live? Oh, yeah, we're live. Hi, Tim. I saw
that. What do you think we've been doing, Sean? Of course we're live, silly goose.
No, we're just chilling.
James said, hi, happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the weekend. All right. Friday. Happy Friday. Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, Sean, that is so lovely. I think that's one of the probably the smoothest transition story I've ever heard. Actually,
it was very smooth. It was very smooth, and it's an anomaly. I know it's not always like that, but I do think that, like, you know, I feel grateful. I feel grateful. I really do. I don't know,
Sean. Did you feel scared? Was there like fear, like, wow, I'm gonna go through this transition? Or you were just like, no, I know, like, this is the right thing to do. This is when I will feel my whole complete true self, you know?
You know, by the time I decided to move forward with a physical transition, I wasn't afraid by then. And I only made that decision once I wasn't afraid. I think a lot of the fear came from, is this the right thing to do spiritually? Because I grew up, like, I have a very strong, like, spiritual foundation, you know? I grew up around spirituality, and I don't say religion because I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to, you know, I spoke to my creator, you know, and I was like, I just want to make sure that what I'm doing is not saying to you that I'm rejecting what I was given. Mm-hmm. You know, and I came to arrive at, you know, well, what I was given was not just a physical body, but a whole being, like your thoughts, your essence. It's all there. All of that is what was given, you know? Yeah. So you can't separate these two. And it's time to kind of unify.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was the most spiritual thing I could do, was like align myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Think about it, Mona. It's like, how can a person, like, do anything in life when you're so, like, when you're going through so much, like, inner turmoil? How can you, like, think beyond
yourself? That's right.
Create anything beautiful or great or anything out there when you're so, like, having such a tough time internally, you know? And I didn't want that anymore.
Now you know how I've been feeling my entire life, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, look, people go through it in different ways. Like, I think everyone has their own journey, but I do think that's the work. I do think that's the work. And, like, conversations like this can be super healing.
Yes. I mean, for me, Sean, honestly, I really didn't know my ass from the hole in the ground for a long time. I would say probably till I hit my late 20s. I really just didn't know, because I'd never been to therapy. I had never really worked out my issues. So they were all just piling on. You know, I was in a relationship. I was married for 9.5 years. The person I was married to was also pretty verbally and psychologically and emotionally abusive. So it's like, you know, they say when you grow up in abuse, it's home. So then you end up marrying somebody who's also abusive, because that's just all you know, right? So you just kind of fall into that. But I think in my 20s is when I really started taking a hang of my life. And I was like, I got to figure this shit out. I can't walk around being this damaged, because I can't function. I literally don't know how to function in the world, because I come across as a weirdo. I feel like a weirdo. I don't understand my own thoughts. I don't understand myself and my true self, and I got to get to it. And I think therapy had been a huge factor for me. What about yourself? Did you kind of go through therapy and kind of work that stuff out too, or was it more just working on your own?
I did go through therapy.
Therapy's great. Listen, I advocate that for everyone.
I do too. I think it can be life-saving for a lot of people. Yes. You know what I mean? I think I sought community. I think that was actually incredibly important for me, because at the time, like, you know, a community shows up in different ways. Like, I was looking at trans people on YouTube, you know, because there was a point in time where I was like, I could not let anybody know what I was thinking or feeling. So I had to find safer ways. So, you know, I'd go to the library and check out books about, you know, written by trans people. You know, I found, like, meetup groups, you know what I mean? Like, I tried to find, like, safe spaces where I could kind of understand that I wasn't alone, that, like, other people go through this, other people, you know. So I think sometimes therapy, like, I would go and I would go again, and I, you know, and I had, I saw a lot of benefit. But I think for me, I found other ways also that really helped out
Mm-hmm. I think it sounds to me like, you know, you grew up in a pretty healthy environment. So I think your biggest kind of challenge, I would say, in a way, was just kind of, you know, I feel, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was it so much even about accepting yourself and the going through that journey? Or was it so much about, you know, worrying about or being concerned about what your parents or your siblings would feel or say?
I mean, both. I think both were there. You know, I don't know ratio-wise or anything, but, like, both were there, I think. Like, you know, first and foremost, like, it took me a while to figure out. Like, I do think it took me a while to figure out, like, that I had to decide first before I would, like, think about everybody else. Because I think I was conditioned to, like, put other people's needs before my own. Right. So I didn't understand that it shouldn't be like that until well into adulthood. You know what I mean? Right. So once I learned how to prioritize, that I'm learning again now, being someone who's been living with his parents, you know, for these many months, I'm learning again how to reprioritize myself. You know, I think our lessons, like, show up over and over in life until we get, like, really good at it.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know about you, but I do, like, journal a lot, and I do, like, write a lot, because sometimes that's the only way I can understand what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, for me, I really started writing things a lot out when my father died. I think that was the big kind of a breakthrough for me, because I also made peace with a part of myself where I was like, oh, my God, my father's gone. I don't need to be in this fucked up abusive relationship that I'm in. I can just move on. I can live my life the way I want to. And that was a big kind of a breakthrough for me. And you know, I mean when my father died is when my insomnia started to kick in. So I think my brain mind would be racing so much that I would have to wake up in the middle of the night and just write my thoughts out. And it wasn't, my mind would not shut off until I would just write all my thoughts out. So that was, I guess, my form of started journaling, you know.
When did you get into comedy though? Because I feel like, do you feel like comedy has been a part of that therapeutic journey for you as well?
Yeah, I mean, comedy has been an absolute lifesaver for me. I think if I didn't become a stand-up comic, I think I would have been in deep trouble. I mean, it's a stand-up. Look, stand-up comedy was never part of the thing. Stand-up comedy is something I just kind of, like, boop, just kind of fell in. I was like, oh, okay, funny. Wait, shit.
What was the thing? What was the thing for you?
So there was this amazing acting coach by the name of Anthony Abson. So, and I had just was going through my divorce at the time, and my ex used to tell me that I'm an untalented piece of shit, that I will never amount to anything. And you know, when you love someone, you believe what they tell you. And he used to be like, "You're fucking garbage. You'll never be anything without me." So I think I was taking acting classes at the time, and I was a stage actor briefly in New York. So I learned about this other acting coach, Anthony Abson, God bless him. I went to his class, and you had to audition for his class. And that's the only way you could get in his class. And I remember going to do an audition, and I remember very specifically telling him this. And I was like, Anthony, if I'm, like, untalented and I don't have it, just let me know. Like, it's fine. I'll just do something else. I'll figure something else out. But just don't lie to me. Just tell me that I suck, I'm untalented, and then I won't pursue this. And he was like, I'll be the judge of that. And I started doing this monologue. And then, like, mid-monologue, he just stopped me. And he was like, can I ask you something? I was like, yeah. He's like, who the fuck told you you're untalented? And I was like, oh, my ex-husband used to say that I'm untalented and I shouldn't really pursue this. Yeah. And he was like, he's like, first of all, what are you doing tonight? I have my class tonight, so you should come to my class. And he goes, second, can you call him after this class and tell him to go fuck himself? And that's what Anthony Abson said. I was like, oh, damn, Anthony coming through right now.
Big time coming through.
His class changed me. Sean, his class was the universe sending me like a lifeline, like literally. Yeah. I would go to his class, and I didn't know you had so much fun doing acting. I didn't know that was a thing, you know. I would have so much fun, and he made me feel so open and so free in his classes that I would say a lot of like funny, crazy shit. And one day he pulled me aside. Okay, I remember this one specific actor, and he was talking about he had gotten booked for a hand job, not, you know, for like, you know, advertising his hand.
Yeah. Okay, I got what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying? Like those hands. Very different kind of a hand job.
Yes.
And I was like, wow. I was like, oh, you're gonna make so much money with your hand jobs. And the whole class fucking erupted in laughter. And Anthony pulled me aside after the class and he was like, you know, you're very funny, right? And I was like, me? He's like, yeah, you're very fucking funny. And I was like, oh, I don't think I'm funny. I just want to be a dramatic actress. He's like, oh, you can still be a dramatic actress, but you're very funny. He said, have you ever considered doing comedy? And I was like, I can't do comedy. Like, I didn't have that kind of confidence in myself. So I was like, no. And then I was briefly working at Morgan Stanley. And there was this girl who worked in a separate department. Yeah, I'm a former finance girl. I used to work on the trading floor in New York City. Yeah.
I don't know that I knew this about you, but that makes so much sense.
Yeah, it does. What about that makes sense to you, Sean?
I don't know. When you said it, I was like, I see it. I see you like ringing the bell in this, whatever they do out there.
Get to it, motherfuckers. Let's go.
That's it.
I mean, listen, I was one of the only four women that worked on that trading floor. I mean, it was fucking doggy dog. Like, guys were brutal. Like, they were fucking mad aggressive.
What do they do? Because this is such a different thing. My dad watches the stocks.
Steal your money, Sean. That's what they do.
No, what are you doing on the floor? Are you just looking at ticker symbols and yelling like Apple 132, Apple 131, Apple 133? What are you doing?
No, so this is, you're thinking more like Wall Street, like downtown. I'm talking about on the trading floor, working for Citibank. So I work for Citibank on the trading floor. We were on the buy side, not the sell side. The sell side's a lot more aggressive than the buy side.
Okay.
But buy side is aggressive too, don't get me wrong. And I started working as an assistant. And then did so well, my boss promoted me and wanted me to become an analyst. So I did.
Dang, Mona. You just said earlier you don't know math. You just said earlier.
And why do you think I don't pursue that fucking career?
Well, you got promoted. I don't know.
I was like, yo, let me make that money and let me get the fuck out. That's what I did.
Maybe there's like a corporate comedy gig back at Citibank. Where
listen, corporate gigs pay a lot of money. Let me tell you, Sean, you make a lot of money doing corporate gigs. Veer Das, who's like the biggest Indian comedian. I don't know if you've heard of him and who he is. Veer gets paid for corporate gigs. I shit you not, for about 30 minutes, he gets paid about upwards of $32,000 US. Yeah, that's how much money he makes. He's and besides that, Veer totally deserves it. He's a lovely human being on top of it. He's great. He's a great dude too, you know? But Sean, I know we have limited time, so I'm going to try to get more to your work. I mean, you have your hands in a lot of things. You're also a producer. You're also an actor. How long did you start pursuing acting?
I got into acting... I had just done 2014. I had just directed a series of videos for a dance app, the Learn Bhangra app. So it's okay. I think now there must be like a couple of apps on the app stores, whatever, that teach you how to do Bhangra. But this was the first one.
Did you say punk rap? Is that what you said?
Bhangra.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I directed a series of dance videos, and I was sitting with my editor. And who was also a musician and actor and photographer and everything, jack of all trades, really, really good at everything. And I was telling him, hey, man, I want to get into acting. And he had known me for a long time. And he had said, you know, you've been saying this for many years. And this was the first time I think I had said it. And I had already started on my transition journey. I was already on testosterone, had like little peach fuzz coming out and stuff like that. And so he said, look, tomorrow I'm going to show you how to get on Actors Access, which I know you know about. You know, and we're going to take your headshots, bring a couple outfits, and I'm going to post you for some gigs. I was like, okay, cool. So he showed me how to do that. And literally in a week, I booked my first gig,
which was
that, by the way, the two people they saw for that role was me and D-Lo. Which is the person that you confused me for when we first.
I did. This is what happens. Sometimes brown people confuse other brown people. That's a thing, apparently.
What's funny is, like, so me and Dila, it was, like, off of Santa Monica Boulevard. It's, like, one of the theaters on Theater Row in L.A. So me and Dila were over there.
Yeah.
Dila goes into the audition first, and then he comes out, and he's like, you got that role. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I can't do it. He was like, I'm not in town. What they're doing this.
Oh, fuck, dude. And what was the role?
It was through the Young Playwrights Festival. So the Young Playwrights Festival happens every summer, every June in LA. And a wonderful theater company called the Blank Theater puts it on. And they have a series of plays that they do at Stella. They hold it at Stella Adler Theater off of Hollywood Boulevard. And so anyway, the show was called The Not Lesbians. And it was a short play about a trans guy meeting his ex-girlfriend for the first time since his transition. And they get together for dinner. And so because I had now transitioned, I was no longer a lesbian. And because she still had feelings for me, she couldn't quite identify as a lesbian either, because now I'm male identified. So the play was called The Not Lesbians. And it was written by a really, really smart 18-year-old.
At the
team, Travis Emile. And so a really sweet play. And so anyway, so that's where I started. I started off in theater. Theater in LA pays nothing. And I realized, I was like, if you don't do something else, you're going to actually lose money doing this work. So I started training for commercials, ended up getting a commercial agent, and then made the transition into like film and TV stuff after that. And so, you know, as well as I do, like this journey, actually, it can take time for people. You know, it's like, you got to be in it for the long haul. You got to put your ego to the side a little bit. Because I think all of us want to bust out the gate and, like, we want to make money. We want those big gigs. We want it all right now. But I'm starting to see, I'm seeing the value in things taking time. Because realistically, as an artist, it's like, you might not always be ready for the big gig.
That's right.
Big gig when you're ready for the big gig. And, you know, get good, get really, really, really good. And when you're there, get better. You know what I mean? Like, keep training. Training is something that I know that I'm always going to do, you know?
Right. I mean, it's like, when does a diamond become a diamond? When it's under pressure. It's not, before that, it's just a coal. It's just a piece of coal.
For sure.
It becomes a diamond when it's under pressure. And I'm not saying that you have to, like, torture yourself or get tortured, but there's a grind. There's a grind and a hustle to acting. There's a grind and a hustle to stand-up comedy. There's a grind and a hustle to becoming a producer, director. Entertainment is a fucking grind. I think, you know, a lot of times, Sean, what happens is, you know, I get this a lot, and I'm sure you get it too, where people are like, oh my God, okay, I'm not going to name any names, but I recently had a fellow Desi woman reach out to me. She follows my work. She's, you know, she wants to become a manager. She's not in the business at all. She does more stuff within the Desi community, right? Within the South Asian community. And I landed my first ABC role, right? My primetime role. And she messaged
me. Yeah, the rookie, right? I saw that.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. And she messages me, and this is what she asked me. She was like, how did you get there? I was like, how did I get where? She's like, how did you get there to getting the role on ABC? And I was like, years of fucking hard work, working on my craft, eating shit, heartbreak, tears, blood, sweat, you name it. It's been it. It's in there. That's how I got here. And I think a lot of people just look at that and they're like, she just got lucky. See, she just got lucky, or that he just got lucky. See, he just got that. I mean, you don't really have to work for it, because people only see your success. People don't see the scars. They don't see the wounds. They don't see the sleepless nights. They don't see, you know, the multiple jobs you had to fucking do to support yourself because you don't have a support system. Like, people don't see that. Is that something that you also experience or have witnessed?
I mean, yeah, I think people do assume, like, people on the outside do assume it's so, they don't see how hard it is.
It's not sexy. Making it is not sexy. It's the, like, farthest thing from fun.
Look, I think you really only get to act maybe like 10% of the time if you're lucky.
That's correct.
The time is like, hustling or working on just being better or like networking or whatever it is. It's like we're doing so many other things. But I will say this. Mm. The one thing that I think is important for folks, you know, that I tell myself too is like, take care of yourself. Like, I don't care what it is, yeah. However demanding you're feeling, if you're off, if something's not feeling right, if you're so stressed that it's like bottling up in here, you need to walk away for a second. Like, go get fresh air, take a walk, do whatever you got to do. But like, don't let that pressure, like you talked about the pressure, like don't let that pressure become so all consuming that you're not enjoying your life. Like, sometimes you have to step back and be like, do I like being alive right now? Do I like being me right now? You know, if the answer is no, then I think it's important not to necessarily like completely change course, but to do something differently. You know what I mean? It's like, how do I just like really like what I'm doing and like myself?
Yeah. Have you experienced those moments?
Yeah, all the time.
Do you also go through this while you're like, you quit in your brain? You're like, that's it. Fuck this. I am out. You know how many times I've quit comedy?
I go through that less now. Yeah. I do go through that less now because I do feel, I feel more calm now. As a person, I feel more calm now. And so I think I also understand it's a matter of time. Don't stop. Like, I see that I have it. Not to sound egotistical or anything, but I think it's important to be honest with ourselves. Like, look, do we have it or do we not have it? If we don't have it, what do we need to get it? And when I say it, I mean the thing. You know what I mean? And that, like, that sauce, that juice, you know, do we have it? You know what I'm saying? Is it there?
What kind of sauce are we talking? Marinara? What kind of sauce are we talking?
Chutney? All the sauce.
What kind of sauce?
Listen. Szechuan? Let's put the chutney in there.
The chutney, the red chili, what are we looking at? What kind of sauce?
Like the sweet chili sauce. I think it's the sweet chili sauce. Ultimately, for me, that's what it is because that's got
sweet chili. I can see that. I can totally see the sweet chili in you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a compliment.
Yeah. Absolutely.
One thing, like, I think because I know that it's there, I'm not giving up. Like, I'm not stopping. It's like, keep going. Just get better. Keep getting better. And, do it quickly. Do it quickly, but like, don't be so hard that it becomes this like inner war. It's not worth it at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because you're like, it's almost like you're running yourself into the ground trying to achieve a goal, but you're miserable the entire time. So it's like, what's the point? Yeah. I think it's taken me a long time to really accept. It's like you hear things which kind of end up becoming a little cliche. It's not about the destination, it's about the journey. It's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And I would hear it and I'm like, yeah. Where's my fucking prize? How do I get to the next level? How do I get to the next thing? And I think more and more now I'm just like, you know what? I work hard. I'm going to take the weekend. I'm going to drive off, go to the beach, have nice lunch with a friend or have nice dinner. Hang out, watch a nice movie, take a walk with my dog. It's taken me a long time to get here to actually just enjoy that.
You know what? I'm going to share something with you. I met somebody years ago.
Yeah.
I don't even remember who it was. It must have been just this one conversation I had with this dude who had said to me that what he does, he was an older, maybe a friend of my dad's or something. I don't remember. But like, he said to me, what I do, at the beginning of every year, I plan all my vacations that year. And then I plan my work. Mm. And I was like, I really love that. I love the prioritization of your own joy. And then everything else after that.
Did he have a family or was he single?
I don't remember even who it was who said that, to be honest with you. But I was like, I never forgot what he said. Yeah. I didn't forget who he was. I'm like, who was that guy? I don't remember. But
he sounds single. He sounds single as fuck, Sean. That's what he sounds like.
Maybe he was. I don't know, but I feel like that's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. I've never heard something like that.
Yeah, it feels like, and you know, vacation doesn't have to be always like, oh, I'm going to go off to like some exotic, or it can be like simple things we do for ourselves, like a road trip a month or something like that.
That's correct. That's what I do. For me, getting away for the weekend or just even one day to Santa Barbara does wonders for my brain. Wonders.
For sure. And knowing that that's coming up is also kind of a big thing, you know?
That's right. What kind of, do you make a lot of road trips when you're in LA? What's your thing?
Yeah, I like to. I like to get to the beach, you know, even staying local, like sometimes. But yeah, I like to get away or go for a nice hike or something. I think we have the benefit of like our hikes and our beach. Like, I think we're all LA folks like to do those things. We're so, so I'm into it.
I don't hike though. I don't really hike much. I have a lower back issue, so I don't really hike much, but I would love to.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think the getaways and the self-care is super important, you know, and then come back and do your thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. Sean, I know I want to be mindful of time. I know it's a little over an hour, so we're going to start wrapping up. What kind of projects are you working on now? Like, I know you're in North Carolina, but what kind of projects, you know, are in the works for you?
Well, I've been lucky that I've been able to manage auditions from here. Mostly everything's via self-tape. So, like, if something comes through, great. I'm getting to write season 2 of These Thems. So I'm working with the show creator, Gretchen Wilder, as well as one of our other talented cast members, T.L. Thompson. And the three of us are writing season 2. It's 80-90% there. It's in really good shape. I'm really proud of it. It's a comedy, you know, and season 2 is looking really great with a lot of heart as well. Yeah. There's a series I've been putting together with a couple of friends, creative collaborators, an anthology series that I can't say a whole lot about.
Okay.
That's in the works. And then there's a couple other shows I'm putting the pitch decks together and developing. So hopefully those are getting out there. But I think part of this work is to continue, not just like as an actor, like speaking other people's words, but also like putting out what you want to put out, like put out the art that you want to put out as well. So continue to develop that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sean, I did want to share it with the world how you and I met. You and I met at Artists Rise Up LA, which also goes by Arula. And they put on these really social conscious shows where they're bringing on actors like yourself, stand-up comedians who are political or who get social justice commentary and, you know, put on sketches and, you know, monologues and stuff like that. And I remember the first time I saw you and I was just like, I know that person. I think I've met that person before. And I was like, did I confuse you for D'Lo there? Is that what I did?
That's exactly where it was.
That's where I confused you for D'Lo.
I kept telling you. I was like, we haven't met.
And I was I know you. You and I. We had samosas together.
Since we talked about D'Lo a couple of times, I do want to say he is such a sweet
D'Lo is the fucking
such a wise, sweet, funny, amazing human being. Like I met D'Lo. Listen, I gotta tell you, I met D'Lo in 2005.
Oh wow!
I met D'Lo because I cast his cousin, his younger cousin, an 8-year-old, Jamin Nanthakumar. I cast him in my student film, and then Jamin, who was 8, I heard him on set one day telling his mom, "You know, that person reminds me of my cousin D'Lo."
And
so I was like, who's your cousin? I was like, who do I remind you of? And then D'Lo, I think, had already graduated from UCLA and had studied ethnomusicology. And we met and I was like, hey, I need someone to do the score for this short film. And so we met, we talked about music, we talked about queerness, we talked about being queer and South Asian. And I almost fucking cried. I felt like I met like a long lost soul.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
You just didn't feel so alone anymore. Maybe.
Yeah.
You were like, okay, all right.
I was super excited. Like I think I called my sister, my younger sister and I are super close and my older sister and I are too, but I think I called my younger sister. I was like, I met someone like me, you know, because like I grew up in North Carolina. I never met anyone like me before.
And so it was
amazing.
I mean, D'Lo is just such a lovely and a wonderful human being. Do they talk to you about, you know, relationships or, you know, do they talk to you about, hey, are you seeing someone? What's the deal? Or it's not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they know. They pretty much know all my stuff. I'm pretty open with them. Plus, I couldn't hide, like, living here this long, I couldn't hide who I was seeing. So I am seeing someone right now.
Awesome.
Yeah. She's super cool.
And she's, is she where you are or is she in LA?
We drove cross country together.
Okay.
And so she's all over the place. By chance, she's back in LA right now. But yeah, I think we've both been kind of all over the place these last like 6-8 months.
I love that.
So, yeah. So my parents met her and everything's cool. Everything's really sweet. So
they're like, beta, are you going to propose?
You know what? No, they're not putting any kind of, they're literally not putting any kind of pressure on me.
I love that.
And, you know, we've been through a lot together. They've seen me go through other relationship heartbreak. They really have. And so yeah. I think at this point, they're really at a point where they're like, just be happy. Like, just be happy. That's all we want for you. And I really do feel that way. So I don't know, man. Like I did some nice things in my previous births, I guess. I feel really blessed.
You have a lot of really lovely, lovely karma. Honestly, maybe you probably did do a lot of lovely things in your past, but I think your current self is so also wonderful. So I'm not shocked to see all these wonderful things come your way.
Listen, I think you're quite lovely yourself. I really enjoyed the conversation with you. I think we always have a good time when we talk.
We always have a great conversation, you and I, Sean. We always bond. We always connect. I mean, I'm sure a lot of artists are feeling that way. Are you missing and kind of itching to just get back up on stage and perform and do?
Yeah,
all these things,
I want to be on set. Like, I miss being on set.
Yeah,
I want to be on set. I want to like act. I want to put stuff out there. Yeah. I am missing that quite a bit. So
yeah, I feel you.
Hopefully soon. But in the meantime, like, I want to just keep getting better. You know, I think that's
That's the way to do it. Sean, this has been a lovely conversation. I know we went 11 minutes overboard. Do you like people to follow you on your Instagram or social media?
For sure.
Where can they follow you?
Instagram would be best. Twitter. I have a Twitter. I really don't use it a whole lot. Facebook is, you know, whatever. But Instagram is at Sean Dasani.
Okay. Nice and easy.
Nice and easy.
Nice and easy. Sean, this was such a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Mona.
All right, my friend. I love you. Take care. I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That was my lovely friend, Sean Dasani. I learned so much about Sean today, and I think Sean learned a lot about me. You guys, I'm so excited for the weekend. I hope you guys have some lovely things lined up for the weekend. If you have not followed me on my YouTube channel, please do. It would really mean the world to me. I'm trying to get up to 1,000 subscribers, okay? I'm at like 805 or something like that. So if you guys can go to youtube.com/Mona Sheikh Comedian, and I'm also on TikTok trying to put out some fun videos. I'm also on Facebook. You can follow me there. And also I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Mona's Comedy. I know some of my fans on Facebook really respond a lot to my sexy photos sometimes, but I try to keep that shit on the DL. You guys have a great weekend. I love you. Stay safe out there. Please put the damn mask on. Good night.